The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay, so I thought I would talk about relating wisely to the aging body today. This is a workshop, a component of a workshop I gave with Ramesh Sarim about 2 weekends ago. So I thought I would just offer some of the material that came up as part of our workshop for this morning's talk. And I like to use the framework of the Four Noble Truths when we talk about our practice. In the Buddha's view, he saw the Four Noble Truths as the elephant's footprint. All other smaller animals' footprints fit inside the elephant's footprint. And in the same sense, it's the framework of the Buddha's teaching in which all other of the Buddha's teachings fit inside. So the Four Noble Truths is a big deal. And it's nice to review them. It's nice to know them. It's nice to live them, actually, as a lifelong practice and also as a moment-to-moment practice. I know I can't be heard sometimes. Are you still hearing me? It's okay? It's difficult? Yeah, maybe we can just bring that up a little. So in short, oh, thank you. Ooh, okay. So in a nutshell, the Four Noble Truths, the first noble truth, there is suffering, right? There is suffering, or in some translations, unsatisfactoriness. The second noble truth, there is a cause. The third noble truth, there is an end. The fourth noble truth is the path out of suffering. So in a nutshell, those are our Four Noble Truths, and I'll go over them more in depth as I go on. In preparing for this talk, I read a book called Beyond Coping, a Study Guide on Aging, Illness, Death, and Separation by Tanisaro Bhikkhu. And I was interested in the first two paragraphs of his introduction, which I'll read to you. An anthropologist once questioned an Eskimo shaman about his tribe's belief system. After putting up with the anthropologist's questions for a while, the shaman finally told him, "Look, we don't believe, we fear." In a similar way, Buddhism starts not with a belief, but with a fear of very present dangers. As the Buddha himself reported, his initial impetus for leaving home and seeking awakening was his comprehension of the great dangers that inevitably follow on birth: aging, illness, death, and separation. The awakening he sought was one that would lead him to a happiness not subject to these things. So in Buddhism, there's a sense of looking clear-eyed at the challenges of being a human being, and or simply being alive. I just want to share, over the last few weeks, our cat died, our cat of 19 years, our temple cat. and it was kind of really startling and shocking all over again to watch a body decline, fade, and pass away. And even just those final moments of death are so kind of unfamiliar to me, to most of us, right? Death is kind of tucked away in corners a lot. And to sort of watch her body, especially in the last moments, I was just talking with Mary beforehand, her cat went through the same thing. And just watching her body, you know, when the consciousness seemed gone, but the body is just sort of lurching for the breath, and the jaw is working, and just sort of the shock of sort of watching the body do this thing which the body's meant to do. It wants to hang on to life, right? So sort of this final lurching of the body, and it was exactly like my father looked. My father, who had a lot of morphine moving through his system, but still the body, it, you know, there was this just sort of quality of violence to me in watching it. I don't know kind of what it was like for her, but yeah, and just opening all the senses, all my senses to this process, I feel like it's a real learning. It's a real learning to witness that. And animals are our brethren. They die like we die. In the same way the body shuts down, the organs shut down, that they stop eating, they stop drinking. So just sort of, really, I had that experience too with her. So the Buddha advised that we become intimate with our suffering, and we become intimate with this difficulty, that there's something to be understood here as opposed to something to be avoided. So this stuff scares us, right? It kind of scares us, and we sort of put it in the dark corners of our culture. The Buddha advised the opposite. Come close. The five remembrances. The first four, I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. In these last years, I've had a real distinct feeling sometimes when I'm in bed with my husband to the right and my cat between my feet, you know, just like this nest of love, like this thing I cherish that just I never wanted to go away, like this is my refuge, you know, that sort of feeling that we can have about things that are so beloved to us. But, you know, I fortunately have kind of heard the teachings of the Buddha, and so right with that feeling of like, you know, it's tempered, and it doesn't make the love and the cherishing any less, but there's a knowing this goes away, this ends, you know, to really live with both of those, you know, this is the truth of our existence. And I'm just reminded too, which I want to share, the other word for dukkha, or the other definition of dukkha, is a wheel off its axle, a wheel out of true. And so it's like when our understanding isn't in alignment with how things are, we are like a wheel off its axle. It's a rough road, right? So our practice is bringing our understanding in line with reality. And then when that's the case, is the ending of dukkha and is the smooth road. So I just think that's a beautiful and useful metaphor. So in those moments when I'm kind of feeling this thing, I notice the flavor of clinging in my heart and the taste of suffering that comes with that. And so that's really important, to be in touch with the contraction of the heart that comes with clinging. It's a distinct flavor. So, the first noble truth, a wheel out of true, when one's misunderstanding is misaligned, dukkha is to be understood versus gotten rid of. So in Pali, understanding also means to stand under. So when we say dukkha is to be understood, there's this sense of standing under in the sense of fully embracing. So understanding has a slightly more nuanced meaning in the sense of embracing or surrendering to being connected with, as opposed to just sort of what one might think of as a mental understanding. I'll just share a story. I was at the Birchwood a few weeks ago. As I was preparing for this talk, actually, I was reading Ajahn Sumedho's The Four Noble Truths, reviewing that, and you know, I noticed as I was sitting there, I kept feeling hungry, even though I'd eaten an entire breakfast. I kept feeling hungry, and I just, the image of a whole nother omelet and pecan roll, it just kept coming up in my mind, and I, you know, I'd see it, and I'd feel it, and it's like, when you've eaten, you know, don't go there, you know, just come back to your work. And I did that, and this happened again and again and again. So finally there was like a flag, like, okay, there's some agitation, there's some restlessness, there's actually some suffering that's happening here. And because I was reading this beautiful Four Noble Truths, right, it's right kind of, my practice is right in front of me, so when, turn to your body, pay attention, be mindful, what's happening. So that's precisely what I did, you know, kind of feeling in my gut, feeling that hole. And we all know this hole where, like, I call it when I want to eat the house. You know, it's like no matter how much we consume, that thing won't be filled. So it's like coming close to that hole. And also I noticed in the heart there was just some contraction. You know, my cat was at home dying at this point. So there was just this thing in the heart that I didn't want to feel because it was too tender, too. And so it was like I saw, oh, there's all this contraction happening now in my jaw and just in seeing that and just in having compassion, just like letting go and just being interested, like, oh, this is the wind that wants to eat the house. Surrendering to the myriad of unpleasant sensations, that sense of surrender. And the magical thing, and I call it magical, it's not the Buddhist words, but it's like when we really submit, when we really allow that dance of energies, when we don't identify like this is me, this is my suffering, but this is just a world of movement, a world of images in the mind that I can just let do the dance. And that was my experience. And when I did that, there was ease. There was a sudden relaxation. So this is a distinct experience when we don't quarrel with our experience, when we let it have its life, we let it have its expression. So the second noble truth, there is a cause to our suffering, and that cause is clinging. It is craving which renews being and is accompanied by relish and lust, relishing this and that. In other words, craving for sensual desires, craving for being, craving for non-being. We know that too, craving for non-being, disappearing into our television or whatever that is, our drugs, our distraction. And for me, you know, the clinging in the moment at the Birchwood, what was the clinging? What was the craving? It was the clinging to be out of this unpleasantness, to be out of the difficulty. An omelet is so much better than kind of coming in contact with this very deep pain. But that's an illusion, right? The omelet isn't better. That's a false promise. False promise. So in talking about kind of a relationship to our aging body and to aging generally, I was just thinking of the cultural forces that we're up against, you know, the cultural forces of delusion. And if we measure our value in terms of our physical vitality, our attractiveness, our level of energetic engagement in the world, our seeming independence, we will begin to feel irrelevant as we age, or worse, we'll feel in the way. So if we have the values, the standard of values that we have during our midlife, and we put them into our old age, into our old aging body, that is a setup for suffering. And our culture does this quite precisely. These are the words of Kathleen Dowling Singh. She has this wonderful book, The Grace in Aging, which I found really useful. She says, without a deeper context, a spiritual context, or orientation beyond self with which to view and to hold this whole experience of human existence, aging is something most of us would not choose, something simply to endure. Actually, I'm just going to read a little bit because this was really powerful. In aging, we may experience the chaos of confronting unexamined beliefs. Perhaps we weren't aware of how much we counted on a desirable appearance or an identity in a function. Perhaps we hadn't realized how attached we've become to respect for our accomplishments and positions, how largely unknown and unnoticed by the younger working crowd that has replaced us in the world. There are some affluent retirement communities where people are referred to as FIPs, formerly important people. It's hard to be a was. We may experience chaos in our reactions to the rudeness and indifference with which we, now among the old, may be treated. Unexpected expenses, illnesses, falls, diminishments push up against our assumptions about the way things should be, push up face first into the unexamined attachments and aversions that have led us through our years. Aware of the insubstantiality of our beliefs and assumptions and egos, we also become aware that there is a far greater power at play here. That far greater power is the awareness in which this chaos, all these whirling thoughts and feelings and sensations, is occurring. That far greater power is the endless play of formless presence, the ground of being, unfolding its ephemeral display of forms. And that far greater power beyond self is beckoning. For practitioners, our practice is open, mindful looking that allows that insight. For the dying at the end of life, the recognition is stark and starkly given, and surrender becomes the only option. So it's not safe to grow unbeautiful. It's not safe to grow fat. It's not safe to grow unattractive. I was getting my hair cut a few weeks ago, and I saw a magazine, a fashion magazine, that said, you know, the cover was, "Love the body you're with." And I thought, I was thinking, oh, you know, I'm on this topic. I thought, oh, let's see what it has to say. On the cover was a picture of Jennifer Lopez, you know, hugging her gorgeous body, right? It's like probably Photoshopped, you know. So these are familiar images, right, to all of us. And so I went inside to look what it said, and they were letters, little letters from women who were talking to the undesirable parts of their body. It was this sort of form of encouragement, like, you know, and the take-home message was work it, you know, find a way to work it, even though you don't like it. You know, that's the take-home message. So it was like, dear big booty, dear pancake butt, dear curves, dear baby bump, you know, and then in big bold letters, work it, you know. And so, like, to me, this is just, yeah. So we can spend our whole life energy trying to work it, right? We can, right? And so this is sort of what she was pointing to. There's another power. There's another place to reside. And so that's what needs to be discovered, and that's what the Buddha is pointing to. Other vistas. The Buddha talked about the arrogance of youth. I really like that phrase, the arrogance of youth. It feels so true. And I heard of this when I was in my 20s, and I'm really grateful, because as a dancer and as, you know, someone who kind of had pride in my physical vitality and all that, it was really tempering. Like, and I would notice arrogance of youth. That was a note that I made to myself often. And even later, I'm thinking of a birthday party I was at when I was 40. This is 12 years ago. And it was a 50-year-old. It was a friend was becoming 50, and it's this sort of monumental time, you know, or half a century. And the discussion was sort of around, you know, 50 is the youth of old age, and kind of these different ways in which we conceptualize 50. And I remember what came up in my mind as I was listening. I was thinking, I'm glad I've got 10 years before I get there. Really. But we do that, right? We think in that way, right? It's sort of like, and then as soon as I heard the words, I felt the taste of clinging. and compassion kicked in. And just like, and also Hiryotapa, wholesome fear, like wind, don't go down that path, not out of some moral stance, but out of the protection of my own heart. That kind of thinking does not lead to liberation, does not lead to the kind of happiness that I'm interested in. So it's important to feel, like I said before, when that clinging arises, to have a sensitivity to that, to the taste of that, and to know that's not the direction, that's not the direction of our refuge. Asking the body not to age is like asking a leaf not to change color. Marcia Rose said that. And so aging is natural. You can see aging as part of nature. It's what we do. So the third noble truth, there is an end, cessation of suffering. What is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? It is the remainderless fading and cessation of that same craving, the rejecting, relinquishing, leaving, and renouncing of it. Yeah. So cessation, you know, we all know this experience of cessation, so not to make it more than what it is. So for instance, my experience in the Birchwood, there was the experience of dukkha, there was the experience of clinging, and there was the experience of cessation, of ease, of letting it go. The Four Noble Truths converge in every moment, and we just need to recognize and practice and develop that wisdom like a muscle, right? Moment to moment, developing that wisdom. Deep mindfulness is an antidote to doubt and confusion. It's a way to move from misalignment to alignment with how things are. We move out of the story and into the direct experience. The direct experience, Buddha knowing Dhamma, right? Buddha awareness. Dhamma, how things are. Buddha knowing Dhamma. It's very simple. And there isn't necessarily a self tangled in that. Awareness with the object being known. It's very pure, very bare. And the self is extra. It's actually a construction. It's a construction of the mind. So this is not a doctrine. It's a place for investigation. It's a question that you can live and explore in your moment-to-moment experience, in your sitting on the cushion. This is Ajahn Sumedho. Through being awake, alert, and no longer attached, we realize cessation and we abide in emptiness where we all merge. There's no person there. People may arise and cease in the emptiness, but there's no person. There's just clarity, awareness, peacefulness, and purity. This is Thich Nhat Hanh. Our greatest pain is caused by our notions of coming and going. Since before time, you have been free. Birth and death are only doors through which we pass, sacred thresholds on our journey. Birth and death are a game of hide and seek. You have never been born, and you can never die. Thich Nhat Hanh speaks in poetic language, but having studied with him, I can tell you he is an inspiring figure. He's a Vietnamese monk, more from the Zen tradition. So again, not hearing these words as doctrine, but as a place for investigation. The fourth noble truth, the way leading to the cessation of suffering, it's the Eightfold Path. So a path that has eight components that can be part of our practice that's divided between conduct, wisdom, and concentration. I won't go into the details of the Eightfold Path because it's quite elaborate, but one component of the Eightfold Path is mindfulness. And so we talk a lot about mindfulness. And the Buddha says right mindfulness. So I think it's an important distinction, the difference between attention, wise attention, and unwise attention. So we can have unwise attention, right? So what is mindfulness? What is right mindfulness? What are the qualities of mind that characterize right mindfulness? So it's a receptive, investigating mind. It's interested. It's not demanding anything different from experience. It's curious. And it's non-judgmental. It's accepting. So those are the qualities of mindfulness that we try to cultivate, that we bring to the cushion. I think a lot about my dance career, my years of standing at the bar, you know, working my legs, and the kind of mindfulness was so full of demand, was so full of needing to fix, and so full of aversion. You know, I wish I had the wisdom I have now that I had then when I was kind of training. There's a lot of suffering, a lot of body suffering. And it's interesting, you know, with kind of when we don't have good feelings about our body, we tend not to want to locate there, right? We want to go elsewhere. So this is an interesting question. The Buddha thought that the first foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness in the body. He really directed, this is an important place to be, to investigate, to get to know. But we tend not to want to hang out there. And that's an interesting question, like, why not? Why not? Why is this not a refuge for us? Why do we want to be elsewhere? And we just see, of course, I don't have to talk about iPhones and computers and all these things that dislocate us out of our actual felt experience. The Buddha says, yet it is just within this fathom-long body with its perception and intellect that I declare that there is the cosmos, the origination of the cosmos, the cessation of the cosmos, and the path of practice leading to the cessation of the cosmos. So those are grand words, right? In this fathom-long body. And the body is always present. So it's really useful as a way to come to know what does it mean to be present. Sometimes we don't really even know what that means to show up in a moment. But the body is present. It can't be anywhere else. So when we tune into the sensitive body, like we're always sensitive, we can't turn our skin off, right? I mean, that can be awful in a certain way if our experience is unpleasant, right? So this is our training too. How do we come deeply into the body, or simply into the body, not even in a deep way, just feeling our feet on the ground as we walk? Sometimes this can be really unfamiliar. We're so dislocated. Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. That was James Joyce. I love that, right? Can just live just outside our body. So we can not want to be in our body because our body can be a source of pain. It can hold trauma. It can be a source of shame, particularly aging body or illness. You know, isn't it funny? Illness is so natural, but it can be a source of shame. We're ashamed of being sick. We're ashamed of being old. Like, what kind of thinking is that, you know? What kind of heart is that? So to recognize our patterns, what we do when we want to dislocate from the body, right, because it's unpleasant, so we ignore. Or we think about, as I was working my legs at the bar, mostly I was in my mind about fixing. Mostly I was in my head about how to fix, how to change. It was an aversive quality that was not actually in touch with the felt experience of my feet moving through space. So this is really interesting to me, because now when I'm at a bar and I'm not attached, I see so much more. It's amazing. It's like, whoa, how could I go through 20 years of performing and never understand about the importance of, like, whether the weight is on my big toe or on my pinky? You know, it's like there are things that I see now that just didn't have the space to enter my awareness because I was in aversion and in thinking more than in body. So this question of pleasant and unpleasant is interesting, and the Buddha also talked about this as essential training, not being afraid to be with unpleasant. We're afraid of unpleasant. We don't even want the tiniest bit of unpleasant, right? We run. We grab after anything that feels good, and we run from anything that feels rotten. There's the story of that metaphor, which I have found really useful, about a 1,000-pound bull with a ring in its nose can be led by an 80-pound boy. If he just needs to pull the string a little bit, because the bull doesn't want to feel that little pain of the ring pressing against the nose. So that bull never knows its power, right? It never knows its power because it's led by this pleasant, unpleasant. You know, doesn't want to feel the least bit of unpleasant. So we are like that bull. And to recognize those patterns in our own behaviors is really important, because it's so limiting if we have no tolerance of unpleasant or no interest in unpleasant. So Mark Coleman says, the body is humbling. When we inhabit the body deeply, we get close to the truth of impermanence. So we can experiment with surrender, with non-resistance. Munindaji calls it the law. Something like the law, it's how it is, and we can practice surrendering to how it is. Maybe I'll just finish with these words of Ajahn Sumedho. The sort of knowledge we gain from Buddhist meditation is humbling. Ajahn Chah calls it earthworm knowledge. It doesn't make you arrogant. It doesn't puff you up. It doesn't make you feel that you are anything or that you have attained anything. In worldly terms, this practice doesn't seem very important or necessary. To some people, thinking about how to solve all the world's problems might seem very important. Compared with these things, watching our breath seems insignificant, and most people think, why waste time doing that? What are you monks doing sitting there? What are you doing to help humanity? You're running away from the real world. But what is the real world? Who is really running away, and from what? What is there to face? We find that what people call the real world is the world they believe in, the world that they are committed to, or the world that we know and are familiar with. But that world is a condition of mind. Meditation is actually confronting the real world, recognizing and acknowledging it as it really is. Now the real world operates on the same pattern of arising and passing as the breath. We're not theorizing about the nature of things. By watching our breath, we're actually observing the way nature is. So there are a lot of kind of ideas here, but we have 5 minutes, so maybe we just kind of open it up to any questions or contributions, anything that came up for you as we were talking. Yeah? Yes, Ajahn Sumedho. And this was from, I highly recommend this. This is from his commentary on the Four Noble Truths. If you just Google Ajahn Sumedho, Four Noble Truths, it's online and it's brilliant. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. I think it needs to get turned on.
Very briefly, in the winter, I walk in a particular indoor mall, and there's a sign in a window that I see every day, and it says, it's framed, the happiest girls are the prettiest girls.
So I was wondering about when you were talking about the magazine and Work It. And I wonder if there's another side to that or another way to think about that. So as a musician, my hands aren't as strong and not as dexterous as they used to be. So instead of relying on big, heavy rhythms and speed, I now have to think more in terms of timing and spacing and melody and those kinds of things. And I took my inspiration really from, I can't remember his first name, but a pianist named Wittgenstein, who lost his hand in World War I, one hand, and Ravel wrote him a piano piece for one hand. And apparently it's gorgeous. I've never really heard it. But so is that working? I mean, that seems like a good thing to me. I don't know, just your comments.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And yeah, absolutely, that feels wise. That feels creative. But I think it's more the quality of attachment. And also, you know, I notice, you know, in just this example of I think I spend personally far too much time worrying about my body, worrying about, you know, like worrying about this thing of like working it. I feel like I could do better in this way. And I recognize how much of my life energy goes into that in a way that won't serve me in the end. And the Buddha says there is this possibility of residing in the unconditioned, right? He talks about the unconditioned. This is something to be discovered. And our bodies go away, you know. Your life as a musician, that goes away. So I think it's just all just awareness of where we're putting our mind, where we're putting our energy, and what in the long run, what in the long run will serve us. It's just a matter of, it's how we take care of ourselves and the people around us as a model, you know. Hope that makes sense.
I was just going to say that, you know, your talk is about, you know, more sort of on the latter end of life. And what I kept thinking listening to your talk was how I do this with my 4-year-old. Like, I spend a lot of time thinking about, oh, I don't want you to get older. Oh, you're getting so much older. And then I'm also thinking at the same time, I'm so glad you're getting a little older, you know, like, and how really messed up that is in a way. Like, I mean, but I never really thought about it in terms of like, if I just spent more time being like, oh, you are where you are. I mean, I even say things to her like, oh, you're not a baby anymore. Oh, I'm so glad you're old enough to do that. Not like, what am I saying? You know, I mean, you know, that's such a, yeah, I don't even know the word, a clinging, judging thing, but on both ends, like, you're not doing it right either way. Like, you're getting too old and you're not young enough, you know? And I don't know. I just found that really interesting to think about.
Yeah.
If you have any comments, you know, like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like, I want you to get older, but I don't want you, but you're getting too old. You know, maybe we think about that when we're older too, you know, like, oh, I'm glad I know that now, but now I'm old, you know, I don't know.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks. That was a lovely talk. Appreciate it. When you said something about the was, it's hard to be the was. Can you elaborate just a little bit on that? Because when you said that, it struck a chord with me. And then I started thinking about all these different things that,
yeah.
I'm a was here and here and here.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I don't know if you can expand on it.
Yeah,
just,
I mean,
summarize it.
Just as a simple example, you know, like, I noticed when I was in the prime of my career, there was a certain adoration that came from all my students, you know, that, you know, there was like, when, you know, all this stuff. And now when I show up to teach with my gray hair and, like, you know, and it's like, there's a whole different response, you know, there's a whole different response. And there's this feeling like having been a was. I mean, not in a way that makes me suffer, you know, like I'm grateful that I know better, but that could be a big source of suffering, that really could, like, to have had this thing that I just assumed is how it was. People just adore me, you know, whatever, you know. But that's not how it goes, you know, for me now. So there's a sense that was then, and it's different now. Yeah. Maybe we could just sit for a moment. I just would like to share, for those of us aging, which is all of us, actually, just want to share a poem just as we sit. So we'll just end with that. So just coming gently into your body. And again, you know, maybe we need to forgive our bodies. Maybe every morning we need to get up and start the day with a deep forgiveness. This poem is called Such Tenderness by Raquel Chalfi. Such tenderness in our body as it abandons us slowly, reluctant to hurt us with a sudden jolt. Gradually, wistfully, like a half-sleeping beauty, it weaves for us tiny wrinkles of light and wisdom. No earthquake cracks, but an airy network of anxiety lines. How kind of our body that it doesn't change our face all at once, that it doesn't break our bones with one blow. No, cautiously, like a pale moon bathing us with its glow, it illumines us with a network of sad nerves, folds our skin in the corners, hardens our spinal cord so we can withstand it all. Such beauty, such tenderness in our body that gradually betrays us, politely prepares us, tells us in whispers bit by bit, hour by hour, that it is leaving.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.